it's a pleasure. But the busy summer, so Dr. Shapiro is back after a couple month hiatus. I believe he'll correct me if we're wrong. The plan, and we don't always go according to plan, but the plan is to have three more classes on reform, finish up really through the Yontif season, three, maybe four classes, and then to start on the Musar movement after Yontif. But with that, we don't really need any further introduction. It's a pleasure to have Dr. Shapiro back with us, and we'll be continuing, or I'm sure he'll give us up to date, but so we can start sort of, you know, fresh. But I guess generation two of the reform movement, very different from generation one and the rabbinic response. Okay, that was a long introduction, but Bakasha, after 2 months, we're entitled. Okay, Mark.
Okay, yes, it was great, great summer. We had a great time. But I will tell you, it's not going to be, well, I don't know if it's going to be three. It could be more than three. And I think when we finish with this, I want to do Rav Zelman Bear Bamberger. And then that'll deal with the Orthodox response. And then we'll move into the Musar movement. By the way, the rabbi didn't mention that the Morocco trip, the discount is ending in a few days. So please join us that. And we have exciting things that we'll announce later trips. Also, for those who had been asking me, the Chakira journal came out a couple of days ago. So you can see the letters of the Rav that I published. Okay. Without any further ado, let's pick up where we left off. It's been almost 3 months. If you recall, we were in the middle of the reform movement. We finished with Geiger. Those who want to get previous classes, you can go on YouTube and see them. You can go on the website. I want to move now to start speaking about the rabbinic conferences. And before doing that, even the case of the rabbi, the reform rabbi who was murdered, or so it's claimed. Let's see whether he was actually murdered by those benighted Orthodox. We shall see. But before that, I need to say one more thing about Abraham Geiger, the great reform leader, because he came up with an idea which now is generally accepted in the Orthodox world, the world of Talmidei Chachamim. Pretty much everyone knows this, but they don't know it comes from Geiger. There are sometimes ideas or discoveries, I should say, which appear so obvious, but it took 1,000 years till someone realized it. I've given some examples in the past. Here's one example. The Mishnah Torah has 1,000 chapters. It took until the 20th century, two people separately counted up, and they both discovered this independently. But the Rambam dies in 1204. It wasn't until, so we're talking over 700 years, till we actually figured this out. Now, that's obviously not an accident. And the Rambam is able to create it in such a way that he gets to 1,000. So that's an example of a truth that took 700 years. To use the Talmudic expression, Mokom yesh liskaderbo. There's room for everyone to add their points. I'm going to tell you now something that Geiger discovered, which is so incredible. It's so obvious, but it wasn't obvious before him. It's not obvious to Shamir Agon. It's not obvious to the Rambam. What am I talking about? Well, we all know we have the tractates of the Talmud, the six orders. We only have, though, in Zerayin, for us, we only have Brachos, and we're missing, we don't have in Taros, but okay, the ones, think of the big tractates, those you do Daf Yomi, you got Moed, Noshim, Nezikin. Why are the tractates of the Talmud in the order they're in? I mean, is there any order to this? You take a look, the most famous example, of course, is Kiddushin, marriage comes after Gittin, divorce. So, of course, the old yeshiva joke is you have to give the refuah, the cure, before the markah, before the disease. But that's just a joke. The real question is, why is Kiddushin after Gittin? And what about Yevamos? And how is Yevamos before Kiddushin? Before all of them. And what about in Nezikin? So what to do about this? Now, this is a big problem. Rav Sharira Gaon, as far as I know, is the first one to deal with this. The early Gaon, the famous Rav Sharira Gaon, I didn't even, in thinking about it, just to give you exact dates of Rav Sharira Gaon, dies 1006. I just checked on the computer here. But who is Rav Sharira? He's the father of Rav High Gold, one of the greatest figures. He's also interesting because he famously says that about Agadot, that when people speak about the like the Gaonic Andalusian tradition of Agadah, that you don't have to, they're not necessary, you don't have to take them, it's not that you don't have to take them literally, that's the Maharal, it's you don't need to accept them. Like you read Ibn Ezra, sometimes he quotes an Agadah, he says, well, I don't accept that. That's this whole tradition, and you see this in Rosh Hashanah. So Rosh Hashanah wrote a letter. Igeres Rosh Hashanah, and we actually have two versions. There's a French version and a Spanish version. But the point of this Igeres, this letter, is to explain the oral tradition, where it comes from, who the great rabbis were, etc. And he takes up this question, what's the order of the tractates? And he says, I'm just reading for summarizing it for you. He says that clearly the halachot are put in such an order in a masechta. But as for the tractates, he's not really sure what to make of this. He comes up with midrashic sort of explanations. So for example, why do you have shkolim and then tainis? Then Yuma. And then you have Sukkah. Well, what do you do with Sukkah and Rosh Hashanah? He doesn't really know. He comes up with some midrashic explanations. He says, clearly you have Shabbos and then you have Erevin. But then he says afterwards you have Pesachim because Pesach is the first of all the holidays. And then Yuma. And then, after Sukkah, you have Beitza because it's one area, and then you have Rosh Hashanah, but why? He doesn't really have good reasons. He says even when Rebbe arranged the Mishnayos, he didn't arrange them as Masechtos, but one after the other. And then he says, if you want to change the order, you can change the order. That's not so important. But he tries to give explanations. But not so convincing. The Rambam takes it up also in the introduction to the Parish of Mishnah. And I have to say that the Rambam's explanations are really, they're drush. They're not serious. I'll give you some examples. He says, for instance, he wants to know why Megillah comes before Moed Katan. He says on both occasions, on Megillah and on Moed Katan, on Purim and on Moed Katan, you can't give a eulogy or a fast. So that's why they go together. Again, this is not. He goes through all of them. It's after Sota. Why does Kiddushin come after Sota? Kiddushin should come before Sota. And he gives midrashic explanations. As for the reason, what about Kiddushin? He says that Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi followed the Torah. The Torah first says that you should write a divorce document, and then she can remarry someone else. So there you see that Gittin comes before Kiddushin. I don't think it's a stretch to say that I don't think it's disrespectful to say this is a stretch. Obviously, Kiddushin should go before Gittin. And he gives other examples like this. So everyone struggled over this, the order of the tractates. Well, lo and behold, it's Abraham Geiger who figured it out. And it goes by the order of the chapters. You start with the big chapters, and then you work your way down. You have to understand that the Bavas were originally one. And so that was a genius thing, that it's based, if you look at it, it's based on how many chapters the tractates have, and it's declining. Now, this was an incredible discovery of Geiger, and it made its way into the Orthodox world. How did it make its way into the Orthodox world? I'm talking about Yeshivish world, because Rav Reuven Margolios, in his book, Yesod HaMishnah, Varichata, pages 26 and on, he cites the Rambam, and then he says the real reason is that the what's the Seder? Seder Malachuti. And then he does what I just told you. He doesn't mention Geiger. He goes through the whole thing, going through all the different Sedarim, and the order, like he says, Kodshim, you start with Zvachim, then it's 14, then Menachos has 13 Prakim, then Chulin has 12, then Bechoros has 9, then Arachin, in yeshivas they call it Erachin. I never quite understood that. I give a lot of credit to Art Scroll. Art Scroll could have gone along with yeshivish pronunciation. They go along with yeshivish nonsense in many other places. You heard my chop, what the Rav Mazuz says. Why? What is yeshivish? Yeshivish because it's full of shibushim. But Art Scroll translates it arachin. It's not horios, it's horiot. So kol kavod to Art Scroll. So arachin is 9 chapters. Then come Temura with 7, Krisos 6, Meila 6, Tamid 5, Midos, and same thing in Seder Taros. You have Kalim with 30. It goes through the list. Olos with 18, et cetera, et cetera. He talks about the Masechta Shavuos, why it has to come before Avodah Zarah, and Edrios, and Masechta Avos, which is 5, and Orayot, Horios, that's 3. So there you go. And but no mention of Geiger. And yet, it's Geiger's thing. Is this plagiarism from Rabbi Reuben Margolios? I'm a big fan of Reuben Margolios. I've even discovered some material of him in this rare periodical that no one knows about, which, in fact, this Hebrew old newspaper I discovered something else. I just was writing it today, so it's on my mind. This is another discovery. Mordechai Kaplan, the figure we spoke a lot about in the show, we've been in courses. Anyone remember where he got his smicha from? Look, he became a rabbi from JTS, but he got the Jewish center wanted him to have a hetara from a recognized old-fashioned rabbi. Now, there's plenty of them in New York, but father, Mordechai Kaplan's father, who was brought to New York by Rav Yaakov Yosef Yisrael Kaplan, was a very close friend of Rabbi Reines. Kaplan was born in the city. I don't know how to pronounce it, Shvenitzion or something. I was in Lithuania this summer, and I passed through all these old towns of important towns like that. So, and then later he moves to Lida. So everyone writes about how Mordechai Kaplan goes back to Europe to get smicha from Rabbi Reines, and he does get smicha. We have the smicha document. The question is, did he go to Lida all the way there? It was unclear. Then we have a document that was published that show in the smicha, actually, which says that in Frankfurt, that he met him in Frankfurt. What's Rabbi Reines doing in Frankfurt? Well, lo and behold, I found in the same newspaper that I will reveal soon that has the, in my blog post, that has the Margolios material. Mordechai Kaplan actually attended in 1908 the Mizrahi Conference in Frankfurt. No one knows this. No one mentions this in any of the biographies dealing with Mordechai Kaplan. Who knew that he was involved in Mizrahi? So he's there together with Rabbi Reines, and that's where he gets the smicha. So I'm a big fan of Rabbi Reuven Margolios. I don't think it's plagiarism the way we usually think of plagiarism. And remember in Saul Lieberman, the Orthodox, for those of you who've read it, there is this idea in the Orthodox world, let's put it, the Haredi world, that just like Elisha, remember Acher, one of the, it says that Acher, he's called Acher, so he's not mentioned by name. So you have this idea that people who've gone to the dark side, who've left the fold, if they say a good idea, some people have the approach that accept the truth from whoever said it and cite it. Others, however, feel that you can't cite them by name. The most you can do is maybe cite the name of the book or say Chacham Echad said. And others just say that that's their punishment, that we can take their ideas, we can drink their water, as it were, without mentioning who they are. So I think Reuven Margolios is following this approach, that, Geiger came up with an interesting idea. We're not going to mention Geiger or that Russia, that Apikoros. So instead, we'll take the idea and you know, it's also, there's another issue here that you can't cite Geiger. If you're Reuven Margolios in a traditional Torah work, you can't cite Geiger, because then no one's going to, from his world, is going to read your books. That's puzzle. Sometimes these people will cite like by just an initial, like they have a real problem because Gershom Scholem published many Kabbalistic texts and you need to cite it. So how do you cite it? So sometimes it's like Gimel Shin, or they'll say Chacham Echad, so he doesn't mention Geiger, and he just says the Rambam does the same thing, by the way, for a different reason, or maybe the same reason, in the Shmona Prakim. The Rambam says that he's going to use ideas of non-Jews, but he's not going to cite them by name. He cites them by name all the time in the Guide of the Perplexed, but he's not going to cite them by name here because, do you remember, the commentary on the Mishnah is a more popular work. He says because there are people, unsophisticated people, who will see the names of these non-Jewish sages, and they will, based on the names, without having any understanding, will say, well, I don't want to read it. In other words, the Rambam is describing a sort of frumkeit that existed 800 years ago in Egypt, that people will see a text that's you're citing a non-Jewish scholar, and they don't want to see it at all. The same sort of frumkeit that comes today. They have a big problem with people like the Abarbanel, because the Abarbanel is always citing non-Jewish scholars and things like that. And those who are with us in Portugal, we spoke a lot about that. But in the yeshiva world, they don't like that. Okay, so that's Reuven Margolius. Now, this became, I'm not going to cause celeb, but a bit of a controversy last summer. And I stepped right in it. Those who read the blog will recall. Because of this book, Talmud Basra on Uksin. It's such a large book. I don't know if you can see how big it is. It's this person in Israel put out a Talmud on Tractate Uksin. Uksin doesn't have a Talmud, only has a Mishnah. So we know that there are people like the Red Senior Rebbe put out a Talmud, and we have some other examples on tractates that don't have a Talmud. So he put out, this person, his name is Yisrael Nasano Rubin, put out together with, you can see it here, it has the Rashi and a Tosfos and everything. Now, I wrote about this on my last blog post, and I think it's an amazing, fascinating work. The guy, I had no idea who this guy was. I have this book, Mashal Kim Lo Yachol. It's a book, Hebrew University PhD, written by Yisrael Nasano Rubin, all about the issue, the question, can God do the impossible? Showing how that in medieval times, the standard view was that no, even God can't do the impossible. God cannot make 2 + 2 = 3. By definition, you can't. And this is not, does not take away from God's omnipotence, because the sentence itself makes no sense. But once you get into the Hasidic teachers, all of a sudden you have this idea. And it's not just before, even the Mokubalim before the Hasidim didn't have this. I think there was one, Menachem Azariah Mifano was like the first one, he says, who says that, no, God can actually do the impossible, the logically impossible. So then I saw online about this Sefer. I got it from Beagle Eisen, but I wasn't sure if it's the same person, because a Hebrew University PhD in philosophy, such a Talmud Chacham like this, I wrote to him, it's the same person. So I'd seen a whole blog post about him. Now, I knew the guy was a bit strange and weird, but I didn't know the extent of it. And then if you read the comments, there's some guys thought that the whole purpose of the post, he thought, I don't know Reuben from Adam, but he thought the whole purpose of the post was to build up this Reuben and make him into one of the Gedolim or something, when it wasn't like that at all. It was, but what do I mean when I say the guy is a crazy man? I'll just show you something here. Where are we? You can listen, for instance, he has a shiur introducing his this new book, and he has a number of shiurim online, interesting shiurim. But just to give you a sense, he comes from a Litvish world, I gather. But someone asks him in the comments on YouTube, why doesn't he have haskamos? Because Sidre Tara, that's the Radzina Rebbe's Gemara, has had he says mea haskamos. So he replies, Anime Olam, he says, first of all, not 100. He had a few haskamos. Listen to this. Anime Olam, lo chashavti levakesh haskama. I never wanted haskama on this day for Reshit ein b'doreinu adam haraoy haskim al anak kamoni. There's no one in this world, none of these, who is able to give haskama to my book. And then he says, what does a sefer of Amdonis need a haskama for? The Chidushim stand on its own. So obviously someone replies to him, what gaiva? Of course it's gaiva. You're seeing that there's no, this Reuben, it seems to think he's the God of Hadar. So he says, there's no rabbi we're great enough to give me a haskama. Strange. Okay, so why do I mention this? Because on the very first page of his Gemara, the very first Tosfos, he deals with this problem of the order, and then he says that Rabbi Margolios, in his book Yesod HaMishnah, Tola HaMatzia Ba'atzmo, he made it seem as he invented this thing that goes in order of chapters of a Harishon, Isarera's a Chacham Geiger. So he quotes a Geiger. Geiger was the first one. And then he has a whole long Tosavos here in which he says that Mezikin, you know, Baba Kamba, Matsi, Babasra used to be only one Masechta. He says that, you know, Yoka Babasra, you can't be confused because Babasra is a lot longer than it actually is chapter wise because the Rashbams are so long. So, but that doesn't really determine how long it is. So that's the issue. And the final thing I want to say about this is the, before we get on to what we need to, by the way, I do have comments and responses, and I'll get to that though at the end of class. Usually I do it the first 10 minutes or 15 minutes. Today I'll do it the last day. In Rav Mazuz's Parsha sheet a few weeks ago, he says as follows. I didn't say it, so you can't stone me. Another reason why they stone him. But, he says as follows. He says that, it's very interesting, he says. This is his Motzei Shabbos shiur. You can see it online. They're all on YouTube. And this is from like the Haredi world, although Haredi, interesting. Those who were with us for all my classes on my latest book, you know all about Rabbi Mazuz. But he says, there's something very interesting in the Quran, the Sefer HaQuran, HaPrakim Shel Hochim Aruch HaKatzar. He says, in the Quran, the chapters go from larger to small. And then from there, he picks up and says, it's the same thing, actually, in our Mishnayos, in Gemara. And he cites Rav Margolios. But then he says, and this is what will get him stoned, as follows. He says, Zot ha-metziyut, sha-parakim holchim lafi ha-arichut. Kol ha-ta'amim shenatan ha-Rambam, him ta'amim de-chukim ma'od, v'lifamim tzrichimim. Okay, and he says the Rambam's positions are not, it's like drushy. But then he says, look at this. After he says that what the Quran did, im hain, that is, if the Muslims, lamdu me'itanu o anachnu mehem, bitufat ha-gaonim, ani lo yadea. He's assuming that the order came about in the time of the Gaonim, and he says that either the Muslims learned it from us or maybe we learned it from them. I don't know. The very fact that he raises this and says that maybe the reason the order of our prakim is because the Gaonim saw what the Quran did and thought this was a good idea that let's do this also in our Mishnayos, that to me is unbelievable. I have no idea whether he's right or not. I never thought of it. But I didn't even know that. Truth is, I didn't know that the Quran chapter has declined from big to small. But for a Rosh Hashiva to suggest that we took this from the Muslims, okay, whatever. He says it. You can check it out. It's in number 316, section 11. Okay, my friends, now let us pick up. And I want to tell you about an amazing story, an incredible story. Which, as far as I know, is unknown, even though there was a time that it was known by everyone, and maybe the version that was known was incorrect. I want to speak about a man. I'm going to show you a picture of him here. His name was Rabbi Abraham Cohn, and his last position was in Lemberg, or Lvov, which you hear about in the news today. And he's the subject of this book by Michael Stanislavski of Harvard, A Murder in Lemberg, Politics, Religion, and Violence in Modern Jewish History. Before summarizing it, let me just read you some of what the book jacket says. Now, this is a book, but the truth is the wording is so big here. I don't know if you could tell by me show it to you. You probably can't see that well, how big the wording is, but this could easily just be an essay. It's 120, well, with about 150 pages, but the wording is so big. If the wording was small, I guess it'd be 100 pages, but it's a very quick read. But here's what it says in the book jacket. How could a Jew kill a Jew for religious and political reasons? Many people asked this question after an Orthodox Jew assassinated Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin in 19... Yitzhak Rabin. By the way, growing up, I always thought it was Rabin. And then I come to Israel. Everyone pronounces it Rabin. I'm not sure. Why isn't it Rabin? Isn't that the way Israelis are supposed to pronounce accent on the second half? Rabin is like the old Ashkenazic way of reading it. Rabin, Perez. But and growing up, it was always Yitzhak Rabin, at least in the schools I went to. But it's actually Rabin. At least that's all I've ever heard in Israel is Rabin. Historian. So many people ask this question after Orthodox Jew assassinated Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin in 1995. But historian Michael Stanislavski couldn't forget it, and he decided to find out everything he could about an obscure and much earlier event that was uncannily similar to Rabin's murder, the 1848 killing by an Orthodox Jew of the Reform Rabbi of Lemberg, now Lviv, Ukraine. Eventually, Stanislavski concluded that this was the first murder of a Jewish leader by a Jew since antiquity, a prelude to 20th century assassinations of Jews by Jews, and a turning point in Jewish history. Whatever it is, it's definitely not a turning point in Jewish history, I can say that. Based on records unavailable for decades, A Murder in Lemberg is the first book about this fascinating case. Okay, interesting, catchy. In the next paragraph, on September 6th, 1848, Abraham Bear Pilpel entered the kitchen of Rabbi Abraham Cohen and his family and poured arsenic in the soup that was being prepared for their dinner. It was actually chicken soup. Within hours, the rabbi and his infant daughter were dead. Was Cohen's murder part of a conservative Jewish backlash to Jewish reform and liberalization in a year of European revolution? Or was he killed simply because he threatened taxes that enriched Lemberg's Orthodox leaders? Okay, wow. So now we have a case where Orthodox Jews decided to kill the Reform rabbi in Lemberg, and he was the official rabbi. The community actually, there were Orthodox rabbis, but the official rabbi, the one who is recognized by the government given the communal salary and all that, that was Cohen. It wasn't, there were Orthodox rabbis who wanted to be this, including Ratzir Shayas and Shir Shlomo Yehuda Rappaport and others, but it was him. So, this is an unbelievable story because don't we hear a lot about the potential for violence inherent in religion? Who was Abraham Cohen? Well, he's appointed rabbi in 1844. He definitely was reform, as I'll mention, and he was assassinated, or so we're told. After he's killed, both of the schools in Lemberg, they used to call it Lemberg, that was the old German name that it was known by, both the schools, the boys' school and the girls' school in Lemberg, were named in his memory. At his funeral, by the way, the Orthodox boycotted the funeral, because they were being accused of the murder, which they denied. That's going to be what's going to complicate the story. Pilpel was tried and found guilty. The Orthodox Rav of the city, his name was Zvi Hirsch Ornstein. He's the son of the former Rav, the author of the Yeshuos Yaakov, important comment on the Shulchan Aruch. He was arrested. He was not tried. All the discussions of this case wonder, like, did Pilpel do this on his own? Was he put up to it by the Orthodox? Incidentally, there's been a lot less violence between Orthodox and non-Orthodox, leaving this case aside, than between Orthodox and Orthodox. Orthodox Jews fought each other not constantly, and we have examples of murder, of Orthodox Jews one with the other, both in the Sabbatian times, with Shabtai Tzvi controversies, and between Hasidim and Misnagdim. And there are also, I don't know of any murders, but there are plenty of violence then and now between Hasidic groups. So this is the story that Abraham Cohen was murdered by this Pilpel. Whether he was put up to it by the Orthodox or not, it clearly is portrayed in all the early sources in the Jewish Encyclopedia and everywhere who deals with it as a religiously inspired murder, an attack against the Reform. And Stanislavski, who has access to archives, archival material that no one else had, sets out to write a whole book on it. And I don't know what to say. And I went back today and I read a couple of the reviews, including one by Rachel Mannequin, and they actually came to the same conclusion I came to. And you have to come to this conclusion. If you read this book, your conclusion has to be that there is no real evidence that this was a murder by the Orthodox. And everything I just read you in the book jacket, it's maybe to sell books or create an exciting story, but this very book provides all the evidence that it wasn't a murder in Lemberg, or at least not a murder like we're led to believe. So, for instance, here's something which isn't in any of the early writings, and Stanislavski deals with it. The fact he deals with it, I don't know how it doesn't change the cover. Pilpul, after being found guilty in the local court, was then found innocent on appeal, and he was found innocent by the Supreme Court in Vienna. So if you have a case where someone is found innocent on appeal twice, that means he's not guilty of murder. So how can you accuse him of murder? You assume he is. Who knows what's he didn't. We have no reason to think he did it. Who knows who did it? We don't know anything, basically. There's other issues as well. Although Cohen is a Reform rabbi, the synagogue in Lemberg is, despite what it's referred to here, is not really Reform. It's it had German sermons. It had a choir, but it didn't have any organ. So yes, going back to the beginning of our classes, that makes a synagogue Reform. But by the mid-19th century, is that really what you mean by Reform? Reform means you have an organ, and you have, let's say, a mixed choir. You have all sorts of things. This is like a liberal shul. So, for instance, I was in Vilna this summer. The only shul remaining, the last shul, it is so Nebuch in Vilna, the place where so many of our great Torah sages were, in such a community, they struggled to get a minyan of old people. It's the whole thing is Nebuch. Very different in Portugal, by the way, which has youth and has a future. There's nothing in Vilna. But the only synagogue still standing is called the Choral Synagogue. It's a synagogue that had a choir. That was the synagogue of the Maskilim, and not the synagogue that the Gedolei Yisrael went to. But is it a Reform synagogue? No, it's what we would call a modern Orthodox or a liberal synagogue. It's not Reform in the sense that it's Reform in the sense the first generation Reform, but not by the mid 19th century. But the point I want to make here is that the person who was accused of the crime was found innocent. And therefore, we have no evidence and we have no reason to think, based on the evidence, that this was an Orthodox murder. How did he die? How did the poison get in? We don't know. Is it poison? Is it is there something in the food that we don't know. It could have been a monetary dispute. Cohen was trying to crack down on all sorts of illegal, unethical monetary practices, but the idea that this was part of a Mechemes Mitzvah, that an Orthodox Jew decided to take into his hands and follow what the Rambam says about Moridim V'lo Malim and getting rid of this Reform rabbi, we have no evidence for that whatsoever. And the one person that you could pin it on, he was found innocent. So I have to say, with all due respect, that it's some yellow journalism here in this book, because that's what the book tells you on the cover. Or what's trying to get to, we have no evidence for that. Why do I say, incidentally, that Cohen is a reformer? Well, because before he came to Lemberg, when he came to Lemberg, he knew he couldn't really practice as a reformer in the synagogue. It's no different than Vienna with Mannheimer, the main synagogue in Vienna. We go there on our tour to Vienna, the Stadttempel there, the main Orthodox synagogue that used to be Reformist type rabbis were rabbis of that shul, but it never had an organ. So although their ideology of the rabbis was reformist or lenient direction of reform, it never functioned as a reform synagogue in practice. But Cohen, a book came out in 1841. Now remember, we began, where did we begin these classes with? 19 classes ago or 20 classes ago in Hamburg. the Hamburg Temple, the Hamburg Prayer Book. Well, this prayer book, the Hamburg Prayer Book, was reprinted in 1841. And when this was reprinted, Chacham Isaac Bernays, who was the Orthodox rabbi in Hamburg, he came out with a statement that, you know, if you use this sitter, you don't fulfill the mitzvah of davening, and a big attack on this. And this, he's the teacher of Shamshon Raphael Hirsch. This led the sympathizers of Reform to come out with a document, a booklet defending the Hamburg Prayer Book. And one of the people who defended it was Abraham Cohen. Well, only Reform rabbis are defending this new prayer book. Now, this might be shocking, though, this idea that, although I told you it's not true, at least there's no evidence that Hopel committed the murder. But if it was true, if he was found guilty and there was evidence, we can understand why someone could have been led to do this. There are texts that speak about what you do to not just a heretic, but a chote u machti asarabim, with the stress on the machti asarabim, the one who leads others astray. I'm impressed that despite all this stuff in the books, in the Gemara and the Rambam, we do not have a history of violence, and we do not have a history of people taking the law into their hands to go after the Reform. We have more examples of different Orthodox groups, in particular Hasidic groups, fighting among each other. So I think people understood that although it's on the books, it's not meant to be carried out in practice. But we do have examples where the ultimate penalty, that is death, was decreed, not against heretics like this, but against what we call Mosrim. A moser or a masur, sometimes they're called. That is one who's an informer, who is allied with the government. And we've had examples going back to Spain. It's unbelievable that in Spain, where Jews had the ability to do capital punishment, the government allowed them to execute informers, even though the informers were the ones informing to the government. But so that's well known what happened in Spain, that the Jews did this. But I'm going to give you an example from closer to our own time. And it's only because I mentioned Reuven Margolios, our friend Reuven Margolios. I'm going to give you an example from Reuven Margolios, who, as I recall, you know, I just thought of this, but I'm certain of this, but let me just check it. Reuven Margolios, yes, he is from Lvov. So everything fits in very well here. Okay. Those who've learned Sanhedrin, you all recognize this sefer. The Margolios, here it is, Margolios Hayam. Classic work on Sanhedrin. It, by the way, it's not Yeshivish Torah. It's not Mitzvah Shalomdos. It's nothing like that. It's just interesting comments and short explanations on in every few lines on every page in Sanhedrin. Now, he then did a similar volume on many other tractates, but it, in fact, at the end of this volume, as I recall, yes, the last page, he says that you shouldn't end one volume without beginning a new one. So he gives us a few comments on Avodah Zarah. But nothing, the other volume, the name escapes me now, is nothing like Margolios Hayam, because the other volume is a book maybe this size, but like 20 different masechtas. But here, if you ever learn Sanhedrin, you need the Margolios Hayam. So if you take a look on his comment to Sanhedrin 46a, Memvav Amud Aleph, on the passage, based in Makin Ve'onshin Shalom Min HaTorah, we know that the sages tell us that in order to set things right, that Beis Din has the authority to give punishments, even if they don't have witnesses, whatever they need to do, they can do. And the Gemara is a famous case where this guy was riding a horse on Shabbos and they executed him. How can you execute someone riding a horse? There's no Torah prohibition there. It's a rabbinic prohibition, and a rabbinic prohibition that's, if, you know, you might pull off a branch. It's very rabbinic, because they're afraid that if this guy is going ahead and do this, then it destroys Shabbos. Other people are going to start doing it. You need to, you know, put a line in the sand. It talks about, was it Shimon Shetach killing the witches? Similar sort of thing. You need to do this. And this, based on this, In Spain, they carried out all sorts of punishments. So he begins by talking about this and gives all sorts of good sources here. We've spoken about this in the past. And then he says that when it comes to Malshinim and Mosrim, Kvar Nispashek HaMinhago Hargam. Because of the law of Rodef, that someone's chasing after you, and the law of Rodef is if someone's chasing after someone to kill him, you kill that person to save the innocent. I just mentioned this the other day in one of my classes, because I'm at a Catholic university, and although in Catholicism you have this notion of a just war, they're not pacifists. They believe in a just war. There still is this also concept of pacifism in Christianity, but even in Catholicism. And I said that as far as Jewish law is concerned, we believe in a just war, but we don't believe in pacifism. And if I'm standing here and I see someone chasing after, let's say, a child to kill the child, and I have a gun and I can shoot this person, save the child, I am obligated to do that. I can't say, well, no, I'm a Quaker, I'm a pacifist, and therefore I can't dirty my hands. No, no, you have an obligation. The Radbaz says you have an obligation as long as you're not putting your own self in danger. So you'd have an obligation. So you can imagine a case where you wouldn't put yourself in danger. You could always do it, but you can't say it's a chiyuv. But if you wouldn't put yourself in danger by doing it, you have to do that. So that's the din of Rodef. And Rodef is used in other connotations as well, including with abortion, by the way. So that's Reuven Margolios. And then he cites a few sources. And then he says as follows. I heard in my youth from my father. So you're talking, Reuven Margolios is born early part of the 1889 he's born. So he heard from in his youth from his father. So you're talking probably mid-19th century, that in his birthplace, Grading, which is near Lviv, there was a Moser, who was a someone who would inform to the government, who was a powerful and a violent person. And listen to this. One Yom Kippur, before Kol Nidre, when this Moser, remember, the Mosrim also go to Shul. They're Shomer Shabbos, too. They just happen to be Mosrim, but they're Shomer Shabbos. When he stood, wrapped in his talus, on the eastern wall, next to the Rav of the city, Hagon Rav Yeshua Kluger, certain people came up to him and grabbed his talus and covered him in it, covered his mouth up, and took him out, B'koach mi'beis ha-midrash ha-gadol. They took him out from the shul, Sha'amar al-yad ha-nahar, which is on the river, V'ishlichuhu l'mata nahar. They killed him, and they threw him to the bottom of the river. Kishaninsa, when they found his body, l'machar b'yom ha-kippurim, his body floated up on Yom Kippur, because they killed him Kol Nidre night. You're allowed to kill a Moser even on Yom Kippur. You're allowed to. Although I wonder why wait the end? Why do it on Yom Kippur? You couldn't do it the day before Yom Kippur. I mean, why do you have to do it dafka on Yom Kippur? There's a passage though that they say that even you can kill him even on Shabbos that comes out on Yom Kippur. So then it says, so then the body came up on Yom Kippur. So they spread the word out that they that he drowned himself. I think it means here actually they smothered him, because it says that they when he was wrapped in his talus, they say safnu et piv, they put it in his mouth. So they, if you especially in those days, if you choke someone like that so they can't breathe or cover their mouth, it would be hard to determine. But okay, so they spread the word that he drowned himself, he committed suicide, and on Yom Kippur they buried him. But then he says, when the police found out about it, they began to investigate. And on Simchas Torah, they dug him out. They took him out of the grave to examine, do an autopsy, how he died. And then they began to get testimony from Mispalei Beis HaMidrash, from the people who were davening in Shul. The rabbi, the people who were staying next to him on the Kotel Mizrach, swore, Nishbu Be'emes, and he swore truthfully, Ki lo ra'u mishot tzioso. Remember, they were against the wall. The rabbi and the others were against the wall, facing the wall. they didn't see, so they could swear truthfully. They knew what was going to happen. Obviously, the Rav gave a psak that they could do this. They swore truthfully. They said that they heard something, but they didn't know what it was. They thought that they were helping him move from one place to another, and they didn't want to look back, and they didn't pay attention to it. And then it says, "Umikol mispalei beis hamidrash hamon adam." From all the people davening, you got to figure 100 people in the beis medrash. Hamon adam rav lo haya gam delator echad. There wasn't one person in the entire shul who would agree to give pratim to the police. Hachakira nimchla is a zman umuichachot. That is, the police investigated, they interviewed the people in the shul, no one said anything, and then they just had to say, give it up. And Rabbi Margolios thinks it's amazing that no one in the shul would turn the people in. But here you have testimony that even in the 19th century, communities had ways to deal with their problems. Okay, I want to now turn to three Reform rabbinic conferences. I'll go a few more minutes, and then I'll get to the comments, and then I'll get to some of the things that people asked me. I have a whole pile. I'll just get to a few of them from 3 weeks ago. But what we're going to do is we're going to talk about three Reform rabbinic conferences. There's later rabbinic conferences. You've heard of them in America, like the Pittsburgh conference, but three back-to-back conferences: Brunswick, Braunschweig, 1844. Frankfurt, 1845, and Breslau, 1846. These conferences would set forth the principles of what is then to be, what will be known from then till today as Reform Judaism. I think before that, we can talk about rabbis and synagogues that are reformers, but a movement with an ideology, which has groups of rabbis getting together, figuring out what we do in our communities, and then going back to their communities, instituting it. And sometimes the conservatives get their way, other times the radicals get their way. We are dealing with an entire movement. And like we said before, it's not reformed Judaism. It's not in the past tense. It's reformed Judaism, present tense, because it continues. Now, most of the participants in these conferences were men in their 30s, men who had traditional backgrounds, yeshiva backgrounds, some of the big reform leaders we already spoke about whole time, and Geiger. But it's the same with all these others. They didn't have reform seminaries then. Geiger, we're going to have a reform seminary, but they all went to yeshivas. Now, some weren't such good learners in yeshiva and pretty much amaratzim, but others were talmidei chachamim. And they were rabbis or preachers. Some were preachers in small communities and even in large communities. You had in Frankfurt, Breslau, and Hamburg, and then you had small communities. It's of note that the preachers, the rabbis in the small communities could do the more damage, really. Because if you're in a city like Hamburg, okay, so you have the Reform rabbi saying one thing, but then you have the Orthodox rabbi contradicting him and saying otherwise, and the people at least know, well, there's the Reform position and the Orthodox position, what would be called Orthodox. But if you're in a small town, one shul, say Germany, you had small towns, you'd have 15 families, 10 families. You have a small, many of these towns didn't have rabbis. You had a rabbi who had a few little towns, and you have one rabbi, and he becomes Reform. And the people are ignorant. What do they know? If he comes to them and says, you know, the great rabbis have decided this year we only need to celebrate one day of Sukkot, not 2 days of Sukkot. What do they know? He's the rabbi. If he says it, so then they listen. It's not like there's another rabbi saying, don't listen. This is not really a rabbi. This is what we call Rabbanim, Resh Ayin Banim. He's a bad rabbi. They didn't have that. And so ironically, it's in the small towns, as I think we'll see, that more damage could be done by the Reform. I said Rabbanim. That's how they used to start calling the Reform rabbis. Ramosha Feinstein, though, if you know his Igros Moshe, he has a way that he refers to non-Orthodox rabbis. Orthodox rabbis are Rav, Reshbet, or Rabbi Reish Bet Yud. When he wants to talk about a non-Orthodox rabbi, it's Reish Aleph Bet Yud Yud, rabbi. So he'll say that, you know, at the synagogue where the rabbi. So rabbi means a non-Orthodox rabbi. So you don't, if he were to call an Orthodox rabbi Reish Aleph Bet Yud Yud, that means it's not good. Okay, I already see it's 9:20, so let me get to the comments here and show you some interesting things that I usually start the class and get into that. But since it's been a while, I wanted to get right into it. So we'll get, when we pick up next week, we're going to get right into the conference, reform conference, what they were doing. And we'll also see some responses. We'll start seeing some of the responses. So let me actually, before I even get to the comments, let me just do a couple of things here. Get it out of the way. First, I see Asher, our good friend Asher. I see him in the picture. He's actually right next to my, in my video, right next to my Mechutanim, who I wish a Shalom Aleichem to. Asher says, could I say something about Professor Halivni Weiss? As a coda, you say, to the Shaul Lieberman classes. You know, I've spoken about Halivni Weiss on a number of occasions. I watched the funeral as well. I recognize a lot of people there. It's, and Rabbi Kelman also spoke about him, the time he spent Shabbos at his house as a, so I don't really want to repeat what I said before, other than say that he was a special, special person. I'm not a Talmudist. I don't want to speak about that, but I can, in terms of his menschlichkeit and of his, and of all the things he knew that wasn't Talmudic oriented, he just was a very special person. And I think over time, his Talmudic, maybe they already have, his Talmudic commentaries will be accepted more in the Orthodox world. It's higher Talmudic criticism, but even if you don't buy it all the way, there's a lot you could learn there. And you know, he was a link to the past. If you haven't read his memoir, I encourage it. I'll add one thing, which I don't think I've ever said before, that his memoir, you can read it on a Shabbos afternoon, really interesting, full of incredible passages. I mean, one that sticks out is in Auschwitz. Somehow there was a page of the Torah, as I recall, or the Beis Yosef, that was used to wrap food or something, whatever. The Nazis had been using it, and the Jews got a hold of this, and this became their most precious possession, passed around. They had one page of a Sefer. Halivni already had smicha. I mean, early on, a Gaon Shebegaonim, when he comes already to America, and he describes it. He's in America. He's with Rav Huttner, his relation with the Satmar Rebbe, and then going to the cemetery, going to the seminary. And cemetery is what they would call it. Going to the people criticize the seminary. There are two things he doesn't discuss in it. When you read his memoir, you have to ask yourself, first of all, how is it that this person in the yeshiva world, coming from his Hungarian background, how he could just pack up and go to the seminary? Leave Orthodoxy and go to conservative Judaism. Talmud Mufak of Rav Huttner. Remember, he's an orphan. He's brought in and is given everything by Rav Huttner. That's the first thing. He never discusses it. So the second thing is, what about his Rebbe, Rav Huttner? He talks about his Rebbe. He talks about Rav Huttner. But Rav Huttner was no fan of the conservative movement. There's all sorts of stories about that and things his... not so pleasant relationship with Shaul Lieberman, even though they are both Sobotka people. But there's nothing in the book. What about Rav Huttner? What was his relationship? I asked Halivni this. I asked him, how come you didn't talk about these things? And he said he didn't talk about Rav Huttner because out of kavod to Rav Huttner. He says that when he went to the seminary, Rav Huttner wouldn't talk to him anymore. He's basically, that was it. No more relationship. He says he spoke to him one more time. He was on a plane going to Israel and Rav Huttner coming back from Israel. And Rav Huttner was on the same plane. And Rav Huttner's assistant or whoever traveled with him came back and told Halivni, in those days, you know, he was known as David Weiss when he was with Rav Huttner, that the Rosh Hashiva wants to speak to him. So he said he went on the plane, he went and spoke to him, and that was it. And Rav Halivni thought that this was a failing of Rav Huttner, the way I understood the way he's saying, that Rav Huttner couldn't accept that Halivni was doing differently than he wanted, and he was very disappointed. It was not pleasant experience for him, and out of kavod to Rav Huttner, he didn't want to write about that. That's the first one. The second one, I have to say, I don't believe what Halivni told me. Halivni said that he had no interest and had nothing, had no connection to the Orthodox conservative disputes. It meant nothing to him. The only thing that was important to him was that when he met Lieberman, who he saw as a goon, unlike anyone else, he said, "I need to be with Lieberman." I don't see how that's believable. I didn't tell this to Olivney, but in the 1950s, anyone going into the into JTS knew you were crossing this boundary and you were entering into the conservative movement. Lieberman was himself was well aware of this. For Olivney to say that this was not even a thought, he must have considered this. He must have had conversations. How is it possible? It's not like he was living in a cave. He knew what this meant. He knew this meant cutting himself off from his Rosh Hashiva. He knew this meant cutting himself off from members of his own family, his extended family. So to say that for him, it was simply that he wanted to learn Torah with the best, that's what he told me. I found it hard to believe. The next thing I want to show you, and then I'll get to the questions. Save this for next class. Some of you asked me, I said that in Israel, we spoke about Rabbi Ralbag. This goes back to the classes Mordechai Kaplan, Rabbi Ralbag, the Triangle K. I said Israel accepts it. The Rabbanut accepts it. And yet the modern Orthodox rabbis in America tell us we can't eat it. And some of you were skeptical of this. I mean, most of you believe what I say, but you wanted the proof. Trust but verify. So I was in Israel a few weeks ago, and I'm in one of these big candy stores, and lo and behold, I remembered. So I made pictures with my phone. I love these phones you carry around. So let me just show you. The proof is in the pudding. Okay, what do I want to start with? Okay, so here you go. Lindt chocolate. I don't know this chocolate per se, but... So look at the hashkacha here from it. Here you got it. Triangle KD, Lochle Afkat Chalav Nachri, Bashkachat HaRav Rabag, Ishur HaRabanut HaRashit LeYisrael. They tell us in America we can't eat it, but in Israel it's under the Rabanut. Here's another example. Is this chocolate? Oh, no, sorry, that's just the one I just did. Sorry, that's the one I just did. Here's another one. Milka. So there you go.
We're not seeing it.
Right on the. Oh, you're not seeing it? Oh, sorry.
The other one either.
Sorry. Yeah, I didn't share the screen. Here
first one as well. We didn't see the first one either.
Oh, you didn't see the first one? I'll get back to it. Sorry. Kashar Chalavi, Ochli Ava Kachav Nachri. Ishur Rabbanut HaRashit. Oh, there's one. Let me give you some other examples. Share my screen just so you know. Another chocolate. This is the Lindt. Again, Ishur. Hashkachat, Triangle Care, Tzotabrit, Ishur, HaRabanut HaRashit LeYisrael. I made a couple others.
Perhaps there was your suggestion.
Okay, I can't see on my screen. There's some more, but I don't know. I closed it by mistake when I showed it to you. I thought I showed it to you. The point is that, again, I'm not telling anyone to eat Triangle K, not eat Triangle K, but you should be aware of the fact that whereas the American modern Orthodox rabbis are telling us one thing, the chief rabbinate, which is usually regarded as more strict and extreme than the American rabbis, they are giving an Ishur and they're accepting Triangle K on a variety of products, not just chocolate. But those are the ones that I saw. So, and the last thing I want to do before I get to the comments is I listened to, you know what, I'll save this for next class. There was a mistake in what I said, but I see it's already 9:29. I'll wait till next week and I'll show you. So let me just get to the comments here, the questions. I see new people here. Thank you. Yes, David, the size of the parochim are in descending order. So you knew it, David, but my David Eisen from Israel. But the question, David, did you know that it was Geiger who said it or it was just in the air? You go to Yeshiva, you hear this. You don't even know that it's Margolios who made it famous, but it goes back to Geiger. Rabbi Kelman, in his new book on Pirkei Avos, Rabbi Kelman's an expert on Pirkei Avos, and he gives a class on it, and he wowed everyone in Portugal with his shiur on Pirkei Avos, including the person who has the largest collection, private or university, of Pirkei Avos books in the world. He deals with it, why Pirkei Avos is in the end of Nezikin. But I don't know if his explanation is the same explanation as, no, as Geiger. No,
I mentioned the Prakim, and actually Marty Lakshin read the introduction. I didn't read the introduction. Yeah. So he writes to me, did you know it was Geiger who came up with that, you know, Chiddush? So I said, no, I didn't know it was Geiger who came up with the Chiddush, but I knew of the idea of descending order. But anyway, so anyways, it's in the introduction, but yes. Thank you.
We said that, you know, the Quran does the same thing. So Susanna says, correctly, I think, maybe the Jews and the Muslims are just following a literary custom. 100%. And also, I don't know that this is, Rav Mazuz assumes that this comes into play in the Gaonic period. I don't know if that's the case. Do we have evidence that it's only in the Gaonic period? Maybe already in the period of Bavel. Pre-Islamic, they had already set the order of the tractates. I don't know if anyone has any evidence, but Rabbi Mazuz assumes it's Gaonic. Ortho on ortho violence. What can I, you know, it's not a new thing. It's been going on for a while. If you come with me to the to Prague next summer, God willing, when we walk across the bridge, the Charles Bridge, you see this unbelievable image there of a crucifix with Hebrew writing, Kadosh, Kadosh, Kadosh. That, the story behind that is also a case of a Moser, of a Jew being Moser on another Jew that led to the other Jew being given the death penalty. In the end, the Jew wasn't killed because these death penalties were usually ways of getting bribes out of the Jews. But unfortunately, we have a long history of Jews fighting among Jews. But what I find always so interesting is that the Moser and the person he mostered, they're both Shomer Shabbos, they're kosher. We're dealing with so-called religious Jews, but they could do all sorts of crazy stuff. Yaakov Yellen says the book jacket's a little misleading. In the book itself, the author, he gives all the evidence, and then he wonders, however, he actually says, could it be that the judges were bribed? In other words, he doesn't want to accept that the appeal is legitimate, which I find problematic a bit as well. But he gives all the evidence. So the point is that the evidence he provides doesn't really go with the image he's trying to put forth. Yes, Thomas says that Isaac Bernays' granddaughter was Sigmund Freud's wife. I discovered a lot of material on this recently about the Bernays-Freud connection. Maybe I'll share it with everyone another time. There was a series of articles in the Jewish Forum years ago, which I discovered. M. Frankel says that he was in Vilna 5 years ago for a security conference. There was also an active Chabad there with young people. The shul was pretty nebuch. They paid old people shul for Shabbos. Yeah, I have to tell you that I was just there, and there's no young people. The Chabad, unfortunately, is nebuch also. They're doing the best they could do. But Shabbos, there was, if it wasn't for the tourists and some Israelis there, we would not have had a minyan. There was no davening for Shabbos afternoon. We, after lunch at the Chabad rabbi's house, we did mincha. And but they get a minyan every day in the morning and evening, arranging it the way you mentioned and with tourists. But there's no youth. There's no future there. It was very sad. And Frank also said that Asaf's book in the original Rebbe discusses murder of a Moser. The Rebbe was implicated, and this ultimately led to his fleeing Russia to Sadagura. And the whole, when you speak about violence, the Rizhin dynasty was persecuted by others, and that led to what, during the Machlokas of Sans and Rizhin, Sans Sadagura, there was violence and all sorts of terrible things. No, I agree with you, iPad. No one today would want to live in a community where the authorities, even the Jewish authorities, have the power to kill people for sins, because that we all know that where this could lead to and the corruption. And in Spain, this took place. And there's some crazy things and terrible things that happened in Spain. I wrote about this on the Sfarim blog post, what they did to a... really, probably just a young Jewish girl, maybe 17 years old, but they They declared her an adulteress and all the terrible things they did. They did not do this in Germany. They didn't do this in France, basically. We don't have evidence of this sort of thing. So, yes, we wouldn't want to live there. But on the other hand, if you're living in a society where you have someone who is an informer and is causing Jews to be put in jail and all sorts of other things, but look, it's a slippery slope, but we could easily see where this would lead. Laserson says, what should you conclude about why such a sensational book was authored by a professor at Columbia, which casts a negative impression on orthodoxy in Eastern Europe? I don't see it that way. I think he begins to write the book knowing the story, that which is a somewhat famous story about the rabbi who was murdered by the Orthodox, and that's the theme, and that's what he wants to write about. But as he gets more and more into the story, and he presents the documentation, it then becomes more complicated, and he presents everything, but he's not willing to take the next step to actually, which the conclusion should have been, I think, that what we see here is casting doubt on what was expected, what was assumed for so long. If you're interested, you can read Rachel Mannequin's review I saw today, where she makes this point as well. Wiesel was very close to Halevi. Wiesel was very close. They came from the same town. Wiesel was also, of course, very close to Shaul Lieberman. And Morty says that the Lindt chocolate is under the Huff K. If you go on United Airlines, they give you a snack. It's a snack that's produced in the Netherlands. It's like a, I don't know what you call it, but a lot of you go on United to Israel, you know what I'm talking about, the snack. It's like a graham crackery type of snack. And everyone gets it, and everyone looks around on the package. And lo and behold, it's a triangle K. It's produced in the Netherlands. We know that Rabbi Rabag was the chief rabbi of Amsterdam. Now, I think it's ironic because most people on the plane, or at least many of the people on the plane, I go during the week. I have a colleague who goes to Israel a lot. He's not Jewish. He always flies the Saturday flight or the Friday night flight. I can't even imagine what that is. No religious Jews on a flight to Israel. But here you have the triangle K. I think most of them don't eat it. All I know is that Rabbi Rakefet says that when I was in high school, we couldn't eat drapes. We were not allowed to bring drakes into the building because it was triangle K. In my family and all my friends, we all ate drakes growing up, but we weren't allowed to bring it into the school. Rabbi Rakefet tells the story that he asked Rav Aaron Soloveitchik, could he eat drakes? Because they were triangle K. And Rav Aaron said he finds it hard to believe that Rabbi Rabag is going to allow tarfus into the product he's giving Ashkacha to. So Rabbi Rakefet also ate drakes, he tells us. But again, it's not for me to wander into these kashrus disputes, but it is interesting that in America this is so problematic, but not in Europe. He was a rav of Amsterdam, and not in Israel. So with that, Ruth says devil dogs. Yes, I never was such a fan of those. Ringdings, I prefer. But okay, with that, thank you all, and I hope to see you all next week. Rabbi Kelman, take it away.
Yeah, they didn't sell drakes in Canada, but we used to go to this summer to New York every summer to visit our family, and we would buy drakes. That was one of the treats. They didn't have any baseball in Toronto and no drakes. So I go to New York, I'd always go to, depending if the Mets or Yankees were at home, and they'll whatever. But okay, that's
supposedly Rabbi Teitz acknowledged, I have to ask him one day, when the OU got the contract, supposedly they didn't make any changes and it was all the same. But I don't know if that's true. And listen, in my forthcoming book, God willing, on the Jewish law in America, I'll deal all with hashgachas, and I'll try to get to the bottom of what was it about triangle K. Rav Moshe held of it. Rav Moshe Feinstein held of it. Rav David held of it. But why triangle K never really made it in America has to be explored.
Yes, as we all know, many of these things go beyond halacha into other factors. Yeah. But
It could be, I spoke to Rabbi Rabag once. He told me that he uses a certain kula that the other hashkachas don't. But he also told me that Rav Yashav told him he could use this kula at industrial plants. So remains to be seen.
Thank you. Please go. We'll see you next week. Tomorrow, doubleheader like we have every day this week, either a doubleheader or a tripleheader. Gila Rosen at 11 o'clock, talking on the warping of time, ideas for Rosh Hashanah, and how the manipulation of time, you know, tshuva's above time. That's tomorrow at 11. And then Rabbi Gedalia Berger continuing his series on the davening of Yontif. Tomorrow he's doing, I think it's called, if Aleinu is in the beginning, why is it at the end? Basically, you know, Aleinu for Malchia, then Aleinu, of course, we say every day in the Siddur. Wednesday, Rabbi Mintz at 9:45. And then the Marty Lection will be speaking at 11. Thursday is Rabbi Alex Israel and Dr. Benny Gesundheit. And then the Parsha Shir this week is giving by Yitzchak at Shalom, Rabbi Yitzchak at Shalom. And then Fridays, there's only one. Okay, that's my Shir on the Siddur. And we look forward to seeing you. And please invite a friend. And we look forward to, you know, enjoy learning. Yontif, it's hard to believe 2 weeks today is already Rosh Hashanah, is already the second night of Rosh Hashanah. So we can, everybody, we should be well, have a good year, peace and health and all good things. And please, God, we'll see you many more times before then. All right. Laila Tov, everybody. Thank you.